Hello and welcome to the Digital Careers Podcast with me, Guy Day, founder of Barton Rock. And today we're going to be discussing how companies can win in the battle against cybercrime, where I'm joined by Jim Stokely, who is the former deputy director for the National Crime Agency's National Cybercrime Unit. And prior to this, Jim spent 25 years in the Metropolitan Police Service in a variety of roles, including as commander for serious and organized crime, and before that, 12 years in counterterrorism. And during Jim's service in the Metropolitan Police, he was commended 10 times, including one judge and two commissioner commendations. So a high-profile guest who I was privileged to be speaking to today. The episode itself takes on a slight difference because Jim and I spoke for a full hour, and the first half was on countering cybercrime. And then we branched out and spoke more broadly about leadership. So I felt it was appropriate to split the episode into two halves. The first will concentrate on cybercrime, and the second will be talking more specifically about leadership and what Jim's learnt through the various roles that he's performed during his career. So I hope you enjoy the shows. Jim, first of all, thanks for joining me on Digital Careers. Really appreciate you getting involved.
Thank you, Guy. Thanks very much, and really pleased to be here.
Well, let's talk about today's conversation, which is basically tackling cybercrime. And what we're going to do is break this down into two parts, basically. So we're going to draw on your experience at the NCA and talk about how businesses should be dealing with the threat of cybercrime and their cyber risk. And then we're going to talk about a people section, which is really about leadership in particular and touching on careers and how you've hired in the past, for example. But before we launch into all of that, I'm going to make you very uncomfortable for just a few minutes because you're going to talk about yourself and a little bit about your career. So can you give us a bit of a potted history of your 27 years of law enforcement, and then we'll touch on the NCA and your current situation?
Sure. Okay. So I started in the Metropolitan Police back in 1993, straight from university. And I was posted initially to Kentish Town, which covered Kentish Town, Camden, King's Cross and Euston, which was quite a lively back in the early 90s. I did my 2 years in uniform. Everyone does in the police in what they call probation. But then throughout my service, I've been a career detective. It was quite clear to me early on that I wanted to be a detective and take that path. So after sort of 6 years, I qualified as a detective and went to the Homicide Command. And then after that, got promoted and went to Brent Borough, where I ran a sexual offences investigation team for a couple of years. And then was lucky enough to get promoted again and set up what we called a cold case rape investigation team, which used new DNA techniques to investigate old crimes. And then in 2004, I joined what was then called the Anti-Terrorist Branch, and it's now called the Counter-Terrorism Command, where I served for 12 years. So most of my service was within the counter-terrorism arena. Privileged and proud to have done that work on 7/7 and 21/7 and various other incidents, both in the UK and overseas. And then in 2016, I left there and joined and became the head of what we call Trident, which is the gang command for the Metropolitan Police. So I was the what they call the OCU commander for that command, and then got promoted to commander in charge of serious and organised crime. And then in 2018, I left and joined the National Crime Agency to an exciting position, which was as deputy director for the National Cybercrime Unit, where I've been for the last 2 years. And I've just left there in order to set up my own company. So I've got an exciting prospect ahead, but that was my time in law enforcement.
Yeah, and obviously best of luck for 21 and ahead with your new venture. But one thing that always strikes me when you talk about your career is just such variety that you've had, and also the profile and the exposure that you've had, which is something we're going to talk about in terms of how you've transitioned from job to job and the leadership qualities that have been required for each new mandate, I suppose. But the NCA, one of the things that sort of strikes me about the NCA is lots of people have heard of the FBI, but haven't necessarily heard of the NCA. So can you talk a little bit about what the NCA's been set up to do? And by the way, the profile of the FBI, we probably have US crime dramas to thank for that because of how much people watch that on TV. But talk a little bit about the NCA and who it specifically serves and your role within it.
So I think that's a fair comment to make there. I mean, I think what's important to remember that is the National Crime Agency is very young in service. So it's only It's about sort of 5 years old, so it's a very young organisation. And essentially what it does is it leads the United Kingdom's fight to cut serious and organised crime. It protects the public, and it does this by targeting and pursuing those criminals who pose the greatest risk to the public in the United Kingdom and overseas. So it has an extraordinary remit. It is has a global footprint. It's a global organisation. But it is quite small, and it looks to not only to lead the fight to cut serious and organised crime, but also does a lot of coordination as well. So around investigation and intelligence gathering. So it is quite new as an organisation, and I think that's probably why everyone's heard of the FBI, but not so many people have heard of the NCA.
So before the NCA was set up, how was all of this managed by, you know, for example, if you take cyber crime and cyber terrorism, obviously it's gathered momentum as the internet has obviously taken off. But how was the NCA's remit managed previously? Was it contained within the National Forces, for example?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So essentially, although the threat has changed, as you quite rightly say, you had years ago, you had what they called the National Crime Squad, which was a similar sort of organisation that did exactly what it said on the tin. So that was 100% focused towards cutting serious and organised crime. And then there were various iterations that occurred. There was SOCA, that then, which was the Serious and Organised Crime Agency, which was more of an intelligence organisation. So it's gone back to being that National Crime Squad type remit. So you're quite right, it was investigated by forces and still is. So there is, so for cybercrime in particular, there is what we call or refer to as Team Cyber UK. And it's a really, really good response to the high end of cyber crime. So you've got the National Crime Agency under the auspices of the NCCU, which was my old unit, but you also have regional organized crime units around the country that have their own specific cyber crime investigation teams. And most forces now have their own cyber crime investigation teams as well. So it's been well funded. But there's a really good structure that gives that sort of local to global response to cyber crime.
Okay, so what I'm hearing there is there's a centralised part and then there's a regionalised part that can concentrate on local, specifically local risks, yeah?
Very much so. So you've got, and each type of crime within, or cyber dependent crime, is graded. So you'll have at the top end a C1, what we call a C1 category of crime would be against some sort of critical national infrastructure, so against an airport or power station or something like that, all the way down to an individual being targeted, which would be graded as a C6. So you have that grading system, which enables you to able to triage and allocate that crime to the correct resource so that you can try and make sure that you serve the victim as best as possible in order to support them, but also to catch the organised criminals that are behind this crime.
Fair enough. Okay, understood. So you talked about this phrase national interest. Now, does national interest boil down to government institutions and organisations in the main, or did you ever get drawn into private company cybercrime issues, for example?
Yeah, no, very much so. So it's basically we respond to anyone that's a victim that falls within the grading system that I spoke about. So it could be a large corporation. In fact, it mostly was. So it could be a financial institution. It could be any number of different companies, but it also could be, you know, a part of government, which obviously I can't discuss, but it could be something like that. It could be part of local government. So it could be any number of different types of institutions, a collection of universities or something like that. So it depended purely on the type of crime that it was or the level of category of crime that it was and the sophistication behind that.
Yeah, so it's tackling wider cybercrime. So let's talk about the threat. It's on the rise quite clearly because we might have been familiar with organisations that have been affected by cybercrime or certainly read plenty of newspaper headlines where there's been high-profile cases quoted. But how much of a rise is there in cybercrime, Jim? So if you take the last few years that you've been on the NCA, how much have you seen it increase and why?
There has been an increase, undoubtedly, and I would say this year more than most. And I think there is an obvious reason for that within the global pandemic that we're all sort of suffering at the moment and the increase that there's been online, that activity. What's interesting, I think, that's changed is probably the type of threat that we face and the complexity of it. I would say that the biggest increase undoubtedly this year has been from what we call ransomware. So a type of malware that would look to infect the system. It would then essentially encrypt all of your data, and then an extortion would be published by the organized crime group behind that group, behind that action. And it might be for, you know, for the release of your data, and the extortion could be, I don't know, say £1 million worth of Bitcoin. You pay that. And if the organized crime group are true to their word, and that's obviously a key element to it, you get a decryption key back with a view to decrypting your data, and then you can get access to your data. That type of crime has increased quite substantially over the last 9 to 10 months. But not only has it increased, it's changed in complexity. So you've got different organized crime groups that are behind that. The majority of them are actually Russian speaking. They're not all based in Russia, but the majority are Russian speaking. And what we started to see is that the ransomware itself would get dropped onto a network. Everything would be encrypted. And you get the extortion, and then what would happen is they would say that we will exfiltrate your data if you don't pay within a certain period of time. Then that changed again to not only would we exfiltrate your data, we would then publish your data. Mm. Now, this becomes hugely significant when you think, and obviously you deal with professionals within data, how important data is to companies, to victims, to confidentiality, to share prices, to confidence within that organization. You start publishing that sensitive data online, then that causes a massive issue for the company in question. We've seen that manifestation and that change of modus operandi from the organized crime groups to become more sophisticated in how they do it. And it is a business for them. You know, there's no getting away from it. I mean, it's unbelievable, but one particular organized crime group, they actually offer an aftercare service. So you pay it's extraordinary, but you pay your extortion, and they'll offer, you know, a service to help you decrypt everything, and then perhaps even offer you some security advice. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. And then
there is a huge irony about that, isn't there?
I know.
No, it's easy to smile at these things, but if you're on the receiving end of these malware, it's destructive.
It's horrific. And also, you know, other people pay the ransom, and then nothing happens at all. So the stuff remains encrypted, the data gets published, and you know, further forward. In fact, what you've done is you've got a massive loss to your organization.
Yeah.
That is undoubtedly the biggest threat that's come out over the last sort of year. And as I said, it's changed in that complexity. But you've also the traditional sort of hacking, your denial of service, your DDoS attacks, all those sorts of things still occur. And what's interesting is how a lot of them offer there's off-the-shelf products that you can buy, so you don't need to have that level of sophistication yourself. You can actually go into dark web forums and buy products and then dispatch them against organizations. You don't have to have that technical capability necessarily yourself or be that technically minded. And we also see a lot of social engineering. And this is something that, you know, companies can do with their staff is to help them and think about what you're publishing online. So you and I, Guy, from a different era around social media. It's something that's happened to us later in life. But for youngsters, you know, social engineering does occur. And when it's coupled with cyber attacks, can be very, very effective.
Yeah, I mean, this point about data, I mean, I say to a lot of people, it presents these huge possibilities. The whole digital realm presents all these wonderful possibilities. Mm. But there is an inherent responsibility on the part of organizations, and I'm talking about government organizations as well as private sector, to safeguard that information. And that's, you know, so there's this huge asset which is digital and data, but there's huge liability of the management and the governance of it. And companies spend an awful lot of money, of course, on that whole infrastructure around that piece. But it sounds from what you're saying is that cyber criminals are just becoming increasingly sophisticated, and you've got to be continually responding and evolving as a company to manage your risk to all intents and purposes. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think there's certain things that you can do. So I think, you know, you've got various different control measures. So if you're, you know, in charge of a company, or, you know, the board members, you know, there's three sort of main control measures that you have in any organization. So that's your people. So it's the men and women that work for your organization. It's your network. So the hardware that you have as a company, and it's the processes and procedures that you have in place. So those are your three sort of control measures. But there's lots of things I think that people can do, and we all have a responsibility to do that. So things like simple things like making your passwords much harder, backing up your data. So have your data air gaps in a separate sort of storage, separate hard drive from your main hard drive, and regularly back that up so that if an encryption does occur, you have got your data. So it might be 2 weeks old, but you've got that data and you can operate again as a company. And you're quite right, actually, in what you say around the responsibility that's held, because when you're in the middle of that crisis and you're trying to deal with that crisis, you do have a responsibility, obviously, to the regulator to report it, but also to your customers, because how you respond in a crisis, and we've seen that this year more than ever, people remember how you respond as an organization in a crisis. So it's vital that you get that right. And you have to be honest with people and say, look, this is what we believe has happened. This is what we're doing to mitigate that risk. And, you know, if you explain it and you're upfront, that's much, much better position to be in than further down the line, sort of hiding it and not sharing it with the regulator. Things like two factors authentication. So that's just makes it much harder for people to get into systems, to hack into systems. And that's where the social engineering thing is really key. If people use the same passwords for lots of different things, you only need one breach, and then the cyber criminals can use that password again for something else and invariably get in because the person or the individual has used the same password over and over again. And things like updating the patches. So when you have your operating systems flash up and they say, you need to install the latest system here, you know, make sure that that's done. So there's lots that I think organizations can do, but it is very much, it's not just all about the board being able to do it. It's about, it's everyone within the organization has a responsibility. And of course, that sort of transposes to the supply chain as well, because it's not just your organization itself. It's, you know, where do you get your products in order, if you're a manufacturing industry, where do you get your products from? So that's all going to be joined and connected as part of your network. So you're only as good as your weakest link. And I think that's, you know, really important to remember. Same with mergers and acquisitions. And we've seen that where companies have taken over other organizations. And perhaps there hasn't necessarily been the correct amount of due diligence around, you know, making a proper security risk assessment of that network. So as a consequence, you inherit failures within a system before you've even started. And it's very difficult because what it doesn't do is add to the product. It doesn't add to the service that the organization provides. So it costs money, doesn't necessarily add to it. What it does do is it stops the company, quite frankly, being utterly destroyed in some instances. And that's why it's so important to get that right.
Yeah. I think like a lot of initiatives in business, you need that sponsorship from the very top to make sure that it filters down through the organization. And it's like I've talked to a lot of my guests on this show about digital transformations and about they're only going to work if the board gets behind it. And I suspect the same is true of investment in software or mechanisms to prevent cybercrime and cyber threats of other types. If you're sitting in a boardroom with a group of board members, Jim, that's clearly a point you'd be making very firmly by the sounds of things then.
Yeah, very much so. And also it's about how you deal with it when it's ongoing. So with those control measures that you have around your systems that are in place, so what's the training within the organization? What do people do around, if they do see a suspicious email, you know, they need to know not to click on it, things like that, because it only takes one thing. With so many things are internet enabled now. It only takes one thing and then suddenly the organized crime group are in. Yeah. And they're, you know, incredibly sophisticated in what they do. They are pure professionals.
Yeah.
So as a consequence, you need a professional response in order to deal with it and mitigate that risk.
So how much, I mean, this probably sounds a bit of a strange question, but how much has COVID had a direct impact on the rise of cybercrime because of other revenue streams that they've previously had dropping as a result of COVID, you know, it might be mobility and inability to travel, for example. But has that also had a kind of inflationary spike on the amount of cybercrime this year?
What's changed undoubtedly is the attack vectors that are used by suspects in order to get into networks. So that has changed as a consequence. So you'd see certainly at the start of the year, you get a lot of spam emails or text that would purport to be from HMRC or from TV licensing, that sort of thing. And then, you know, you click on it and then suddenly the suspects are in your, or criminals are within your system. And what we saw change quite quickly was the HMRC and TV licensing sort of phishing emails went away. What it was replaced with was things around vaccination, around PPE, all that sort of stuff. So you did see it change relatively quickly, probably 3 to 4 weeks, and you started to see that attack vector change. Of course, what else you've got, I think undoubtedly, is that a lot of people working remotely. So as a consequence, you've not got such good security around people's domestic setup. Their Wi-Fi, their routers at home tend to be not as professional and as secure as what you would expect to see within a business environment. So as a consequence, there is more work that takes place online. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is that work is probably less secure than it was before. So as a consequence, we have seen, I think it's fair to say, there has been a rise as a consequence of that. But it's also the levels of sophistication that I spoke about at the start around ransomware. That, I think, was starting to happen anyway. And I think what's happened is this has probably just expedited that process.
I think
it was inevitable that it was going to progress.
In our sort of part two of this conversation, we're going to talk a bit about, you know, people. But one thing that I've read about is that there's an increasing number of younger people getting dragged into cybercrime, Jim. Is this a trend that you're observing? And if you are seeing it, what do you think companies and governments should be doing to try to counter it, I suppose?
There's a lot of work that we're doing within law enforcement anyway around that. So it would fall under what we call our Prevent program. So you're quite right. There are younger people coming into that level of criminality or that type of criminality, as you would expect. So the UK has a, again, probably slightly over our heads, Guy, but the UK has a quite a strong gaming industry. Gaming is a massive, you know, it's a massive thing. And a lot of people will start off in their gaming careers. You know, they'll play games against their friends online, that sort of stuff. Then they'll want to beat their friends. So they end up working out a way of DDoSing or kicking their friends off the system. So denial of service. Then they'll want to, you know, get the top scores against other people they're playing against. Look at different ways of corrupting the game in order to get more lives or more ammunition, depending on what they're playing. And then before you know it, they've strayed from being just competitive to committing offences under the Computer Misuse Act. And it's quite a fine line. And I think as people, as young people are exploring their skills online, they don't always know where that line is. And they step over that line. And then, you know, the next thing is, well, yes, I can hack into Call of Duty, but it would be more fun to hack into the Pentagon, you know, and before you know it, people can be going down that line. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that all gamers become hackers, but what we do see is that the majority of hackers have started off doing these sort of exploration through gaming in the first instance. So what are we doing about it as law enforcement? So it is a really, really interesting time, actually, because when you think about schooling, for example, you are in where you have IT lessons. This is the first time ever that you'll have some children within that classroom that will know more than the teacher in that particular subject. Now, that's never happened before. It's never happened in maths or geography or whatever. So that's really interesting. And how do you deal with that? So we've done a lot of work with the national curriculum around making sure that references to the Computer Misuse Act are in there and educating through the Department for Education children around what the Computer Misuse Act is. We do a lot of work online with, we've got some various different things that we work with NCSC, who are part of GCHQ, around cybersecurity challenge. So if people are really interested in that sort of work, there's really good cybersecurity challenges that people can do. So there are online forums and competitions. There's what we call cyber challenges as well within just law enforcement. So it's around sort of educating parents, as well as teachers, as well as individuals themselves. And then we also have a what we call a Google Ads campaign that's worked really well actually with Google. So if you're a certain demographic and you put into the search engine how to commit a DDoS attack, what it'll come back with, it redirects you automatically to the National Crime Agency website and explains that that is actually an offence under the Computer Misuse Act, what you could get if you were sentenced to prison, etc. So there's a lot of education that's done around that work. And I think it's really, really important for young people to be able to express themselves and test those skills, but to do it lawfully.
Mm, okay. Interesting. Well, we might even touch on that in the later section when you're talking about leadership and, you know, obviously strong influence and all these sorts of things. But final question on the business section. How at the National Crime Agency you use data to make decisions? Because, you know, without going into the intimate details of your structure, which I'm not expecting, how, as a, you know, if you don't mind me saying, a non-data professional in the traditional sense, how did you use data as a leader to make the right decisions, Jim?
So data is obviously used to conduct threat analysis. It's used to spot trends. It's used to identify common attack vectors, commonality between victims. And so it's used very much as an analytical tool in various different ways. So I talked about the prevent side of things, and that's one area where we use data a lot, is around understanding how individuals get into cybercrime in the first instance. So that's why, you know, data is really important around that, but also around protecting victims. So where you have commonality in attack vectors, and you can see that through proper data analysis, how do we look at protecting industry, looking at giving advice to industry and to individuals? So that's done with partners within NCSC and across law enforcement across the UK. And that's really, really important. But also using data around, not just as an intelligence tool, but as an investigative tool. So how do we, you know, obviously through good database analysis is how you will capture suspects as well. So data is used in that arena, but also in preparation. So preparing, exercising, all those sorts of things. So if you have, you deal with a big incident that occurs, there is a very much a debrief ethos within the agency that would look at, okay, so what went well? Why did it go well? What could have gone better? Why didn't it go so well? And what could we do to improve? And I think that's really important. So you use data there as well. So you use data across all aspects of what we do in order to be more efficient, in order to adapt, but ultimately in order to protect the victims and protect people within the UK.
Yeah. And what about sort of, I suppose, risk assessment in terms of using data? I mean, in terms of trying to evaluate the size of a risk, I mean, how would you determine that, for example? I mean, you know, I suppose what I'm talking about risk assessment is how real is that threat versus, you know, quite a large number of hoax threats, for example. How do you work through that and make a key decision on how much resource to deploy, for example?
That'll be done through, so we have standard sort of risk assessments that are done. So you look at, yeah, the credibility of it, you look at, you know, who's behind it, you look at what the impact would be, and you measure all that. So it ultimately it is scored, so we would look to score that. But generally you will be dealing with an incident, and then you will be able to assess the threat, risk and harm that that incident poses to the UK, quite frankly, and UK interest, and then look to resource elements according to that risk. And there'll always be slight outliers where it might be a huge risk around public confidence or something like that, which is a very real risk in order to mitigate. So, you know, maybe that you have to put more resources in order just to make sure that you reassure the public around a particular incident. And that's done in a dynamic way. And so we have our own command and control structures that would take place. And if you've got a large incident running, as you would expect, you would have a series of what we would call goal groups that would sit, depending on the type of threat that it was. They could sit daily, they could sit twice a day, depends on what the threat is. And that is assessed continually. And then you will change resources according to the threat as you see fit.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to bring this sort of the business section in a sort of talking specifically about cybercrime to a conclusion there, but it's, you know, what I'm hearing from your answers to those questions is that, number one, it's on the rise. It's becoming increasingly sophisticated. Companies need to be doing as much as they can. It's got to be led from the top to counter what is probably going to be a trend that will continue for the foreseeable future. So that concludes part one of this episode, where Jim had some fascinating insights into how much more sophisticated cybercrime was becoming and provided recommendations around three core pillars of people, network and infrastructure, and finally, people and processes to combat the risks that companies face. Remember, next week's show will be a continuation of my discussion with Jim, where we concentrate specifically on leadership and what Jim's learned both heading the NCA's National Cybercrime Unit, but also from some other high-profile roles he's assumed, such as Commander for Organized Crime, and also his role in counterterrorism. Now, if you like what you hear, please don't forget to give Digital Careers a rating, and you can watch the full-length version of this video on the knowledge section of my website, bartonrock.com. And remember, if you're looking for advice around your digital career or looking to hire within digital, get in touch with me on guy@bartonrock.com.